Right, we'd like to welcome you to the Central Rack meeting this evening. We appreciate your willingness and your desire to make a difference. And we invite you, and we're glad that you're here. We'll hope you feel free to comment. We'd like to recognize John Bear out there in the audience as one of our wildlife board members, and there's numerous other division folks here as well. As you know, I'm just going to go through the rules and procedures and the stuff that we do here, and it's a public forum that allows you to express your ideas, and we encourage you to do so, but the RAC will consider your ideas and opinions, and then we'll report on it to the Wildlife Board, and then they actually have the ultimate decision. I'm sure you're all aware of that. We, all of us, have our own ideas about what's best for wildlife, and I know, you know, we approach those ideas with a high degree of passion and intensity, and that's part of what makes you guys unique and makes you good workers for wildlife. But as we do that, we need to just be careful that we don't become condescending. We need to respect one another's opinions. We need to keep our emotions in check and allow individuals to freely express their opinions, not have them feel intimidated in any way. On the table, if you entered, most of you saw these. You saw the comment cards. If you'd like to participate in the meeting, unless it's just a question, if you'd like to make a comment, you need to fill out one of those comment cards and bring them up here, and I will call on you to make the comment. Typically, for each presentation, there'll be a 10 to 15 minute presentation by the division on background information and also the division's proposal. Yeah, just in. Also the division's proposal. At the end of each presentation, I'll ask the RAC members if they have any questions or points of clarifications where they can ask for whatever they want regarding the information they just heard. Then I'll ask the audience if they have any questions. And if you have any questions, you would be invited to come forward to the microphone. I need you, if you would, to state your name and if you represent an organization, who you represent, or if you're representing yourself, just mention that. And it is the time for questions. This isn't the time for comments or recommendations or anything like that. Once everybody in the audience has their questions satisfied, we'll close the question period, and then we'll ask for public comments, at which point in time I'll go through these yellow cards and I will call your names, and you'll be invited to come forward to the mic. I need to have you again state your name and the group you're representing, or if you're representing yourself. Time-wise, if you're representing yourself, you have 3 minutes to comment. If you're representing the group, you have five. And we actually try and time that and keep that. We have to be out of this room by 10 o'clock tonight, or that's what we're shooting for. So we're going to try and keep on. Also, a lot of times, you know, listen carefully to the comments that are being made, because commonly somebody else said almost word for word what you want to say, and it's frustrating, and you can just stand and say, I agree, or I concur, or I support what was just said. But anyway, let's be conscious of the time. Anyway, is there anybody else that needs a comment card? Okay, first up, Ron will be sitting in for John Fairchild, and so he'll take the places and add the support material that John would normally add to us. We're going to introduce the RAC members, and we'll start over here with Christine.
Sarah Flinders with the Forest Service.
Chris Schmitz, non-consumptive.
Tim Fair, at large.
Jacob Steele, Goshute Tribe.
Richard Hansen, at large.
Matt Clark, sportsman's rep.
Carl Hurst, sportsman's rep.
Mike Gates, BLM.
George Holmes, agriculture.
Jay Price, elected officials.
And I'm Gary Nilsen. I'm the RAC chair. I'm a sportsman's rep, so I guess I would be consumptive as opposed to non-consumptive. But anyway, a couple of other things. You guys, you've had a chance to look at the minutes from last meeting and also look at the agenda for this meeting. I'll entertain a motion to approve. Motion's made. Gets in a second. All in favor? Okay, motion carries. Wildlife Board update. There was quite a host of action items. Last time we had the turkey management plan, and it passed unanimously. The turkey plant transplant plan also, the proposal for it also passed. The upland game and wild turkey recommendations passed as they were presented. They did change the starting days just a little bit. The game birds rule and amendment passed unanimously. The waterfowl recommendation, which is the one that you remember had the crow information inside of it, passed 3-2, but they had a meeting later. The rest of the items that were up passed. John Bear was at that special crow meeting for the Wildlife Board. They had one, was it last week? And I've asked him if he'd take the mic and just tell us a little bit about what transpired there.
Well, we got together. Chairman Albert called the meeting to order, explained how we were going to conduct. We then gave everybody there, whether they represented an organization or themselves, 2 minutes to speak, and they had 1 hour. So we listened to, at the end of 1 hour, there was four individuals left, so Chairman Albrecht decided we'd go ahead and let those four individuals speak. There was a couple hundred people there. It was very well attended. Then we took a break. They gave us about 20 minutes. We split up in two groups, went into the back rooms and read all the written comments that we had received, and then we came back out and voted on all the issues again. The two issues that were addressed at that meeting were the depredation, the allowing of depredation take for crows, and the sport hunt for crows. The depredation take passed 5-0. The sport hunt passed 3-2. So, and that was, and after that passed, that was the end of the meeting. Those were the two issues, and I'm sure you've read about it in the paper. So, but it's over.
Thank you, John. All right, next we'll have our regional update, and Ron will give us that in place of Dr. Fairchild.
Okay, John just wanted me to go through the different sections and some of the significant changes in the programs or things that are going on. In the aquatics program, we have one of our native aquatics biologists is moving on. He's resigning in the middle of September. Mark Grover, I don't know if you know him. He's been a tremendous asset. He came from the education field, actually teaching college, to come to work for us to get more field experience, and now he's moving on to do more teaching. He's exceptional at that. We'll miss him. We're in the process of stocking brook trout on the Manti next week. There's a series of beaver ponds that we stock there. The Mill Creek restoration treatment, if you're familiar with that, will continue on September 9th and 10th. They will do the second treatment of the upper section with rotenone. They'll begin the initial treatment of the middle section, and then they will, after that, begin stocking the upper section with Bonneville cutthroat later in the fall after this, the dissipation of the treatment. They will also address a dam safety issue on Deep Lake down on the Manti, if you're familiar with that. The Mill Hollow Dam construction started this week. It won't affect the stocking schedule. The reservoir will be maintained at half full, if you're familiar, if you fish that area. The wildlife program, the West Desert Pronghorn Survey, is taking place. Covey's hoping that we process pretty fast out of here because he's got a reservation at the Calio Cabin later tonight. We're finishing up. We're at the tail end of an elk classification period. They're in the process of the pronghorn trapping, the planning the pronghorn trapping for the Parker Mountain herd. We will be receiving some of the antelope that they're pulling off the Parker, and we'll be putting them in the Fish Springs area. They're doing the habitat assessment on the Deep Creek Mountain Range this week to determine the suitability for a mountain goat transplant out on the Deep Creeks. The mule deer management plans are being completed and will be presented. You'll see that here tonight. They're working on the Rocky Mountain Bighorn sheep and goat plans, and they've got a September deadline for that. The habitat section, obviously pretty busy with fires that have been going on, Carfork, some Carfork property that we manage out by Tooele. about 913 acres burned out there. The Deep Creek Fire burned about 675 acres. That's the Deep Creek Fire. When they talk about that, they're talking about the Levan Fire. That's what portion of it is division managed that we'll be doing restoration work on. We're participating with the UDOT team to review the mitigation options for reducing big game and vehicle collisions on Highway 89 between Mount Pleasant and Gunnison. Assessing the impacts of Olmsted power plant replacement project with the Fish and Wildlife. That's all scheduled to happen in the fall of 2015, if you're familiar with the Olmsted diversion in Provo. And working to get a better access for the anglers and DWR fishing trucks, the stocking trucks at Tibble Fork Reservoir. Conservation outreach. Recently purchased a drone. I guess we're trying to be like the feds. I don't know. Purchased a drone that takes high-definition video for promoting activities, monitoring projects, and a lot of things. It's an amazing piece of equipment that I don't think we've even begun to scratch the surface of the usefulness on habitat projects and other things like that. A lot of the purpose behind that is to get information out to you about what's going on and what we're doing, and that's a good tool for that. They will be conducting interviews this month to fill a wildlife recreation specialist. There's been some restructuring within the section, and this will be actually the first position filled of that type in that section or within the division. If you are a dedicated hunter, you realize that we're coming down to crunch time to get your hours in. And under law enforcement, we do have a new officer coming in. It is his real name. His name is Lucas McTaggart. He does not work for McDonald's, and he will be working up in the Heber area.
Thank you. Our first item tonight is an action item. It's the turkey depredation rule, and it's a new rule, R657-69, and Jason Robinson, the Upland Game Coordinator, will be presenting it.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Jason Robinson, Upland Game Coordinator, out of the Salt Lake City office. I'm going to be talking about the turkey depredation rule, which is 657-69. Just to give a little bit of background before we dive into the actual rule, turkeys were extirpated from many areas in the U.S., and there was actually some concern of actual extinction of turkeys early in the 1900s. Turkey numbers were at their lowest in the 1930s. Evidence shows that wild turkeys are native to Utah. There's pictographs, petroglyphs, turkey bones, archaeological evidence. I actually included a few photos there showing some petroglyphs of will look to be turkey footprints and turkey tracks. Reintroduction efforts in Utah started as early as the 1920s. Aggressive and more successful efforts began in 1989. Turkey populations are now doing very well in the state of Utah. And one of the things we want to promote and make people aware is this is truly a wildlife success story, both for Utah as well as the nation. And we want to continue to promote that. However, when you have an increasing population, a new species, it's created some human-turkey conflicts, and that's kind of what we're here to talk about tonight. You may remember from the last RAC meeting, I presented a management plan to you, and that plan was approved by the Wildlife Board in June of 2014. And goal B under that management plan is to minimize human-wild turkey conflicts, and more specifically, decrease the number of chronic material damage complaints by 25%. Again, a little bit of background. Going back a year and a half ago, Bill 342, Wild Turkey Management, was presented to the state legislature, ultimately passed, which created Utah Code 2317.5.1, which basically requires DWR to investigate and mitigate material damage to private property caused by wild turkeys. The division will respond within 72 hours of that complaint. We have a variety of tools available to us, including hazing, transplants, and additional hunts. It also gives general rulemaking authority to the Wildlife Board to administer provisions related to property damage caused by turkeys, which is essentially what I'm here tonight is to kind of proposed this rule, which is 657-69. So kind of to summarize, this law is in place. It was passed. And so what this rule does is it gives more detail to that rule and allows the division to administer that law that's in place. So going specifically into the rule, if a turkey causes material damage to private property, the property owner reports it to the DWR. Material damage is defined as physical impacts to private property caused by turkeys that are visible, persistent, and detrimental to the landowner or lessee use of the private property. The Division of Wildlife will respond within 72 hours of receiving that notice. The division may remove the turkeys or implement a damage mitigation and prevention plan that would be approved by the landowner and ultimately signed by both the division and the landowner. So within the turkey damage mitigation and prevention plan, the division may provide educational materials to the landowner to help increase tolerance of turkeys, haze the turkeys off of the private property, exclude the turkeys, including fences, tarps, and other means, capture and relocate the turkeys, and this will be one of our main tools for handling these incidents. Allow additional harvest, either through limited entry or general season permits. Sign the property up in our walk-in access program or the CWMU program. Offer a depredation hunt on the property. Offer control permits to the landowner or control permit vouchers, and we'll go into detail of each of those here. So capture and relocate, very successful history of capture and relocate here in the state. That's why turkeys are doing so well, is we've been very active in capturing and moving those birds. And we know if we capture them and put them in the right habitat, they do well. So we would move them to the RAC and board approved sites. Again, you may recall from the last RAC meeting, the board approved 231 sites statewide. So there's plenty of places here in Utah to move these turkeys to. It is a very effective tool. Again, we're still trying to grow the turkey population here in the state of Utah. But capture and relocate doesn't work all the time in every situation. So we need additional tools in our toolbox. So the division may offer a depredation hunt, which is a focused response to verified reports of material damage. These hunts are in small areas with short notice, limited number of permits available. If a hunter is interested in participating, they'd apply for this on our depredation pool online. And then once a hunt was started, those individuals would be selected randomly. That individual must have a valid hunting or combination license and must purchase a turkey hunting permit. The DWR regional supervisor would approve the boundary, season dates, bag limits, sex of the harvest, etc., for each of those depredation hunts. Control permits for turkeys, they may be part of the damage and mitigation and prevention plan. Maximum of 2 control permits per calendar year would be offered. They would be for the landowner or lessee or immediate family member or employee. And each of these free control permits is valid for one either sex turkey on the private property. So essentially it's a free permit for the landowner to harvest up to 2 turkeys on their private property. There's also control permit vouchers, which may be part of the damage mitigation and prevention plan. DWR may issue vouchers for up to 10% of the documented turkeys on the private property with a maximum of 15 vouchers per calendar year. These would be for landowner or lessee or designated third-party recipient, which essentially means the landowner could choose somebody outside of his family or an employee to get those vouchers. A landowner may not gain financial compensation for the voucher's use. A voucher allows the holder to purchase a control permit, and that person must have a valid hunting or combination license to redeem the voucher. And again, each control permit is valid for one either sex turkey on the private property. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Are there any questions or points of clarification from the RAC?
The landowner cannot be compensated for the voucher then?
Correct.
And I'm wondering why that decision is made. Obviously, you're giving up because there's been destruction.
Yeah, so the way we looked at it is we wanted to try and take care of the problem. And so we can either catch those birds and move them that are causing damage or harvest some of them, which will harvest some of the birds and move some of them away. The landowner can still select the individual to come and hunt on his property. And the other probably main reason is we didn't want to incentivize landowners to complain just so they could get the permits to then sell them off. And so ultimately the decision would be to... Okay.
Because I really don't think that's an incentive for a landowner.
And what
I find that offensive.
What we're trying to do is ultimately solve the problem, which is getting the turkeys off of the property, which is moving them and allowing some harvest.
I got a question. So in dealing with these landowners, how many of them are in support of this type of a amendment or rule? I mean, are most landowners willing to let people on and come and hunt these turkeys? Or
it's actually one of the requirements. If they sign into one of these mitigation and damage plans, the part of that agreement would be to allow hunters onto the property if they get the depredation hunt or either the control permits. Because again, we want to help them get the problem solved. In general, I think landowners have been pretty supportive of allowing the division to have some tools to help them deal with these problems when they occur.
Go ahead.
And the permit is only good on the landowner's property, right?
There is a stipulation in there that we can allow a buffer beyond the property owner. But the adjoining landowner would have to be in agreement to allow hunters on that. So they'd have to be part of that plan as well.
Any other questions from the RAC? Okay, seeing none. Go ahead, George.
There are, yeah. I think we currently have 5 in the state.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions from the RAC? Okay, any questions or points of clarification from the audience? Would you come to the mic, please?
Al Robb, I just represent myself. I was just wondering where it stated that, unless I misunderstood, that there might be CWMUs for turkeys in these instances where they're in the mitigation process. I thought CWMUs were set up for the landowner to charge fees to hunt on the property. Is that the case here?
It is, but those guys, at least my understanding is that CWMUs, you can buy a turkey tag on a CWMU or draw one, but then these are the places like at the where Salt Creek Canyon comes down where they just yard in the winter. And I've listened to these guys and then watched. Turkeys get really smart when you start hunting them. You know, if you're not hunting them, you could run over 30 with your car if you wanted. But as soon as they're hunted, you don't see them anymore. And I think it's kind of a clever solution to some of the problems that they're having.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the audience? Okay, seeing none, we'll bring it back to the RAC for their further discussion and possibly a motion.
I'll make a motion that we accept the turkey depredation rule as presented.
Okay, motion is made by Matt, seconded by Tim. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. No, I didn't. Thank you. All right, I'm going to back up just a hair. Are there any comments from the audience about the turkey issue? Okay. I'll close the comment period. Would you please?
I'd like to make a motion that we accept the turkey depredation rule as presented.
Thank you. Motion is made. Seconded by Tim. All in favor? Good. Motion passes unanimously. All right. Our next item is also an action item. It's a proposed fee schedule for fiscal year 2015. Kenny Johnson will be presenting that. He's with the Administrative Services, and he's the section chief.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, RAC members, members of the public. Kenny Johnson from Salt Lake, the Admin Services Chief, and tonight we're going to cover the proposed fees that we have for these would go into place for FY16, so a year from now in July is kind of the time frame on these. So really quick, the process, and I think this is old hat for most of us in this room who've sat through this presentation before. The process, the fees are brought through our public process first. So we present our proposals here at the RACs, and then we take anything that comes from the RAC proposal to the board. And then from the Wildlife Board, we actually work directly with the governor's office, and they review and make recommendations to the legislature. From then, during the legislative process, we work with our Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee, and they either approve, modify, or reject the fee proposal. And then any fees that the committee approves actually go into the big bill and are included in the big annual appropriations bill, and they're voted on by all the legislators. And then if it passes there, they take effect the next July 1st, the next fiscal year. So we're looking at July 1st of 2015 for the fees we're going to talk about tonight. Really quick, division funding overview. Most of us are familiar with this, at least to some extent. The majority of our operating revenue comes from sportsmen, from hunters and anglers and trappers and everybody that pays to participate in something they love to do. And that's represented by that bigger green slice of pie up there. And then we get a little bit of federal aid match that helps us do more with those dollars, and that's that 29% or so. And then 12% dedicated credits, that's a lot of co-op agreements and things we do with other agencies and other partners. And then a little tiny bit of general fund, that tiny 9% sliver up there. And that's just general fund from the Utah legislature usually. And so what that means for us is we try to walk the fine balance with covering our cost to do business with people paying to participate. And so every once in a while we look at what's going on in the world and see if we're covering our costs and if we need to make some changes. And so for this year, for the presentation tonight, we've got a couple new opportunities, fees that don't exist yet, and then a couple proposals to some existing fees, and we'll just jump right into them and start. So looking at what's left, so just those four bullets. Bobcat, we'll be talking about a fee change. Muskrat, we'll be talking about a fee change, but then a change in the way that process works entirely that will come out at a later point. A new permit for a 2-cow elk tag, so that's a new opportunity. And then we'll be looking at Rocky Mountain and Desert Bighorn ewe hunting opportunities, perhaps. And we'll talk about that being a new fee. And just a reminder, this presentation establishes the fees. So this everything we talk about tonight goes through that legislative process and essentially becomes a placeholder in the fee schedule. So anything we haven't really, fleshed out or completely implemented, some of the concepts behind some of these ideas will come through the RAC later for when we implement them. So tonight kind of establishes the fees. And then at some future point, we'll bring out some clarifying information on how we're going to implement a couple of these items. So everything all told here tonight, the new revenue, we expect to generate between $60,000 and $107,000, $110,000 worth of new revenue. And a lot of that depends on a presentation you're going to hear after mine and what we do with Bobcat permit numbers for the upcoming years. And so I hadn't really planned for that in my presentation initially, and so I've changed my presentation just a little bit and included some projections based on both what we did last year and what we predict might happen if we change the Bobcat recommendations. So I'll show you those here in just a minute. And really the idea, the revenue is to contribute the funds we need to continue managing these programs and providing the services at the levels that we do currently. So for Bobcat specifically, our costs continue to increase. Specifically, I mean, some of the specific things that are associated to rabbit transects, tooth aging, jaw and pelt sealing, and enforcement activities. And you know, the costs of doing all of those things have increased over the years. We've seen pelt prices. The average last year was reported to us at $407. Right now, so these last three bullets are important. The program costs us on average about $190,000 annually. And at the other RAC presentations, what I didn't know was additionally what enforcement effort was being made there. And so we ran some analysis today. And so it's $191,000 average the last couple of years, plus that $40,000 or so, the $39,000 in the law enforcement effort, which puts us at about a $230,000 annual cost for the Bobcat program and fur bearer impacts in general. So what we're proposing tonight, the current Bobcat revenue for residents is $5 a license. We sold 4,400 to residents last year for $22,000 in revenue. Non-residents, same price, $5, a couple hundred of those to non-residents for, you know, $1,000. The fur bearer license itself, I wanted to make sure that the Bobcat trappers get credit for this in the data. They do have to buy a fur bearer permit, which is $29 and brings in roughly that $69,000 in revenue for residents and about just under $10,000 for non-residents. So the total license contribution to the fur bearer program is about $100,000, just over $100,000 annually. And so the annual program costs are that $191 that we just talked about, plus the enforcement costs, which puts us up to that $230. So you can see the shortfall based, you know, without the enforcement costs. We're still short of managing that program by between, you know, $90,000 and $100,000. So what we're proposing to do is take the Bobcat fee that's in place currently, the $5, and increase it to $15. And here's the slide that's based on last year's actual sales. So you can see that if all things were the same and last year's program was mirrored this year, the new fee would bring us about $50,000 in revenue, $52,000. And then if we kind of consider what you'll see in this next presentation, and I don't want to steal Leslie's thunder, but we're looking at a potentially no quota and six Bobcat tags per person. We would you can kind of see the math just plays out. The current fee of 5 to 15, we estimate a quantity of those at about just over 9,000 Bobcat tags. Our highest year, Bill will have to correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was just over 11,000 permits at $5. And so what we did to get to that estimate is we think that fee increase would change the buying behavior a little bit. And so we estimated that would be decreased by about 20%. So that's where we came up with the estimated quantity. And again, it's just a forecast. We don't know exactly what will happen. Could be way less than that. It could be more. And then we are proposing to move non-resident Bobcats from 5 up to 45. And again, not very many of them come into our state to do that, but would bring us a little bit additional revenue from non-residents. So that's Bobcat. Muskrat, we'll just kind of move through them in order. So this one isn't, it's important to note, this isn't really recreational trapping. This program is intended to meet a real specific need on our waterfowl management areas. And so what we're trying to do is get the right people in there removing muskrats at critical times of the year and taking care of the problem muskrat populations. And so right now the current fee structure doesn't really ensure that this happens for us. So what we're proposing tonight specifically is that we drop this fee from the fee schedule. Right now we have a fee schedule placeholder that's $30 to $155, and that's dependent on the number of muskrats that a trapper anticipates catching. And so right now, the way that works, it's a kind of a random process. We have 12 of these opportunities available, and right now we're generating from those 12 that $560 annually. So it doesn't bring us anything. We knew it didn't. But what we want to propose is that we drop this from the fee schedule and work smarter in the future to actually make this something we can put out for contract, put it out for bid, and let the right people come in and tell us what they'll remove and put it out for bid. And so that's kind of what we're proposing here tonight. We suspect that this will be more effective for removing those muskrats, and it'll increase revenue a little bit. We're not projecting a lot. We don't know what this will do, but right now the estimated quantity on those 12 permits, essentially, we're guessing somewhere around $200 each, and so little tiny bit of revenue, $2,400 for muskrat versus the $500. The two cow permit we talked about, this is a brand new fee, so this one doesn't exist currently, so the current fee is zero. We're proposing for residents $80. We estimate we'll use somewhere around 40, depending on how it's implemented. It could offset some of the current permits that are already out there. And so the best way to estimate our revenue was to guess how many of these might be used. And so, again, 80 for residents, 350 for non-residents. So we don't think we'll sell very many to non-residents, so we've projected 4. And again, what this does, it gives us a tool of for the future. We don't have any real concrete plans to implement it right now today. We just want to get it as an option and something we can plan for in one of the upcoming plans and seasons. So ewe hunting, really quick, this is another brand new opportunity. We wanted to just kind of make this option available too. We don't have a fee right now for ewes. And so right now, removing the problem animals that we see, and maybe somebody can clarify if we need to, what we predict we'll use this for in the future. I've learned over the course of the RACs that it's really not an overpopulation thing, but just more management of those populations. And when we get animals moving to places we don't want them to go, rather than us, that second bullet, rather than our people going and removing them, we think it's a unique opportunity to offer that to the public and let them have an opportunity to remove some of those ewes. And so that's what we're proposing with this right here, just a new kind of unique opportunity. And what we're predicting is $100 for residents, and again, we just guessed at 10 as a quantity. Maybe more than that, maybe less. But again, just establish as a place that we can actually think about this in the future and use it to the public's advantage if we get to that place. So, in summary, again, a couple minor fee adjustments. We just think it offers some unique opportunity to the public. It offers our managers some tools they can use to manage populations. And then it brings a small amount of revenue that will contribute to the ongoing management of those programs. And that is all I have. Thank you.
Just a second. We'll have a chance.
That's all I've got.
We'll have a chance. All right. We'd like to recognize Director Sheehan here with us tonight as well. Any questions from the RAC about the presentation? Yes.
I have a couple. I'll start with the bobcat. So are the program costs that you showed us at the $230,000, is that solely for bobcat management, for law enforcement and the biologist, or is that cost actually actually distributed over other discipline areas, like other types of wildlife management.
What?
Is that just strictly for bobcat?
It's strictly for our fur bearer program, which the majority of that is bobcat. There's a handful of other opportunities. Martin, somebody help me with
beaver, muskrat.
Beaver's a big one. So there are more, but the lion's share of everything we do revolves around the bobcat in that program.
And the law enforcement is not shared. That is just law enforcement for fur bear.
Specifically for fur bear. Yep. Yep. Right now, an antlerless elk is
$50. And in the two-tag elk scenario, can two people share those tags, or is that one person that can harvest
That's a fair question. Right now, we're looking at it purely as one person being able to harvest two elk on a place we need that to happen.
Thank you.
Tim.
You know, not really. The fur bearer license itself, like we saw, was 29, and that's where the lion's share of that revenue comes from anyway. So this was just a way to share it across the place that's having the most impact, which is the bobcat world.
And that's a yearly fee, $29?
Yes.
It's a trapping license, isn't it?
Yep.
Any other questions from the rec?
Danny's got one down here.
Go ahead, Danny.
Yeah, Ken. So the 3x increase for residents, you know, inconsequential. 9x increase for non-residents. Wouldn't that kind of scare those guys right away?
You know, they're already participating in really low numbers, but we, you know, if they're avid enough, I don't think it'll scare them away the way the market is right at the moment.
Carl,
there are other states that have sheep ewe tags. I'm trying to get my Wi-Fi to work, but my memory says they're significantly more than 300 on that. While I get this work, can you remember what the other states are charging non-residents?
You know, I don't know off the top of my head. I'd have to do some research and find out. We could do that quick.
I have a question. So, with the bobcats, you're increasing it, you know, three times. Are you increasing? Each hunter can take six. They can trap six bobcats every year.
Last year it was three. The proposal you'll see here in a minute is for six. Yes.
So there is an increase in opportunity as well as an increase in fee.
That's the, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then on the muskrats, is there just fee required to trap on the state-owned WMAs? Or, I mean, if somebody wants to go down to Utah Lake and trap, does he have to get a permit to do that?
He's got to have his fur harvester.
Okay.
But outside of that, no.
That's it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Thanks.
Richard.
So to clarify, just a trap number for those.
Yes.
So basically what you're trying to do is just cover your costs.
Yes.
Is that, you know, within, okay. Let me ask you this. Do fishermen cover their costs?
They're getting better. They're getting closer.
Yeah.
With the change in combo a couple years ago, we converted a lot of people to combination licenses, and so the balance is closer. They're not right at the moment, to answer your question, but it's closer.
So basically, big game hunters make up the difference for everybody right now?
Yep.
Okay.
Any other questions from the rack? Questions from the audience? Would you step to the
mic? I'd like to ask him about the two.
You got to go to the mic, Rob.
Please.
We got to be able to go to the slide.
That was your name.
Randall Cox, and I'm from Sterling. If you put a 2-cow elk permit out, what's that going to do to the elk herd?
Again, so right now tonight we're just getting the fee in place.
Right, but if you give 2-cow permits,
we don't plan on doing that across the board. So for everything we're issuing now, it's not in the works to replace cow hunting with this 2-cow permit. Just in places where the elk densities are high and maybe access is lower, and it makes some sense to let one guy go in and take care of two.
Right, but how many of these permits will you put out?
So I think the thing is that this is just, it's a tool to use in
areas
where we're overpopulation objective. So if we have an area where we have more elk than we've agreed to have, there are people who are more successful at harvesting elk. They're individuals who are good at it. And if they had an opportunity to harvest two, that would help us manage to the population objective that we've agreed to.
Then how would you know when to stop this?
The same way we always do. Elk are great because we can fly them every couple of years, and we know exactly, well, not exactly, we know how many we have on the landscape.
Okay. Let me ask you about the 6 bobcat permits. What's that going to do to the bobcat population?
We're going to get to that in that next presentation.
Okay.
And there's far more qualified people to answer that one.
All right.
But the idea is that there won't be a great impact, but we'll let Leslie explain that here in a minute.
It's not okay. About qualified, it's just we don't have time for your answer.
That's all I have.
Any other questions from Al?
Al Robb, I'm representing myself. I have 3 questions. First, considering the graph you had up there with the different pieces of the pie that represented where it came from, and you talked about the federal aid, doesn't that in fact come from sportsmen via Pittman Robertson and stuff like that?
Yes, that's exactly where that comes
money?
From. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Another thing is pertaining to the numbers you had up there. You had something about pelt prices. I want to know where that figures in to anything to do with what the division does with the, because that should be irrelevant as far as I'm concerned anyway.
It was just the number
individual fur buyer or fur taker that's receiving that, and with the cost of going afield, then.
Yeah, it was the average reported to us this year, so I just included it so people would know one more of the market drivers out there.
All right, I just wanted that clarified a little. And the other thing is with fur bearer permits and the tags, one gentleman asked, I think, if it was right to be charging other states more money. Most of our neighboring states charge us higher fees to go there, and like Nevada does not allow bobcat harvest by non-residents. Plus, you can't even bring coyote pelts out of the state legally. So I think I wanted to comment. I think that's high time that the division has done something like that, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the audience? Would you step to the mic, state your name? And again, this is a question period. We'll have a comment period right following this.
Kent Bobber, representing myself. You guys are pushing everybody out of this realm. Everything in the state of Utah has jumped up on their fees. I got a 14-year-old boy there that loves to trap. I can't afford $15 a tag. How many of us has got medical needs? How many people don't make $40,000? When are you guys going to think about us instead of the increase of everything that you guys are doing? You're pushing everybody away. You want everybody involved in this, but we're getting tired of paying the fees. When's it going to end? Can you guarantee me a $400 average on bobcats this year?
Nope.
Okay, that price should have just been completely out. I've sold bobcats for $80 a pop. Why don't you just up it maybe $7? $15 is a joke. You're robbing from the people that's making you job, and you're making it to where we're not going to participate in anything anymore. Did you ever think about that? That's something you better think about. There's a lot of people out there that don't have a lot of money, that loves this sport, loves all the sports, and you guys are pushing them away. It's got to end.
Thank you. You know, maybe just to revisit a couple of the concepts in the slides. Really, we just need to, we've got to survive to allow wildlife to survive.
And so
we can't keep subsidizing essentially some of these programs with dollars from other interests. It's hard, and so I get it. It's a balance, and that's why we're here tonight. It's what we're trying to do.
Thank you. Any other questions from the audience? Yes.
Shane Carter from Payson, Utah. The Bobcat Wildlife Study and the Harvest Study, is that a necessary tool to continue on with the study of that plan, and how much money is actually allocated for that? And one other point, Wyoming charges $200 for a non-resident trap and permit.
Yeah, that's a good question. Not speaking for the program managers, I would say absolutely. It's critical to assessing the health and the populations that are out there and is necessary.
So to clarify, it's not a harvest study. It's our harvest survey that we do to determine how many bobcat permits we can put out the following year. So that's what we're paying for with this.
So the hair samples, the two samples, is that included in your piece of the
product? Yes, yes. That would be part of what we're subsidizing with this money.
Any other questions from the audience? Okay, I only have one comment card. Kent Fowden.
Mr. Chairman, members of the RAC, appreciate your time. I am Kent Fowden. I am here tonight for the Utah Trappers Association. We strongly oppose a 200% increase in the fees, in the proposed fee schedule. It hasn't been looked at in 30 years. If there were to be a fee increase, we would ask that it be looked at incrementally. If it was a public utility, a 200% increase would be unheard of. So we would ask that be looked at. The muskrats, we applaud the Fish and Game for that proposal. The managers of the waterfowl, they need that tool. The non-residents, we support that. The rest of it, I really can't talk to. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Any other comments? Anybody else? Yeah, when you're done, we fill out one of these cards and bring it up when you're finished. Just go ahead and comment, and then just fill it out when you're done. No.
I'm Deanne Butler, and I'm from Payson. I'm representing myself. I've been told that if I have a problem, maybe I should also have a theory behind it that would help it. Okay, I saw the 191 that you had up there, that you had to check every bobcat's tooth and hair, is that right? So I'm thinking, okay, they've got to do that. What about, though, if maybe you don't check every bobcat that comes in? What if you only did every other or something? Because a lot of those cats will come from possibly the same area. So you wouldn't have to increase that three times up if you only did one and then skip two. You see what I'm saying? So you wouldn't have to do every one of them. And that could decrease that cost, possibly even by half if you only did a certain number.
To answer your question, we currently do that. We don't send every tooth or jaw in for aging. We do a subsample. So we take everything that we get, and then we pick samples from each of the areas that we send in so that we're not spending money on every single tooth. So we already do that.
But you do pull from every one, right?
We collect them all. We require that they be turned in, but we don't send them all in. We take a subsample of what's turned in to us. So it is a subsample. We don't send in everyone.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments from the audience? All right. We'll bring it back to the rack for further discussion.
Just by way of information on the ewe tags in Colorado, for any of us in the room to go hunt a Rocky Mountain ewe, it's $2,000. They do not give you a, non-residents a cut for the ewe. So I would support, if they're getting them and at least go to what the ram tag cost is for the non-resident, and if nobody wants it, and we're going to do this, it goes to a resident.
Yeah, I'm anticipating quite a bit of discussion on some of those items in the coming year, you know, as they come through the RAC process. Any other comments or entertain? Tim?
So I think I understood in your presentation that you said that you considered that there would be a drop-off in the number of people who are trapping, and that you estimate that at about 20%. Did you have any basis for that that estimate? Did you talk to any of the folks around there? We heard from a couple of folks tonight that that might take them out. Are they at that the 20%?
We don't think we'll see a drop off in trappers per se. That was kind of a prediction on buying behavior. So if the price increases a little bit, we think that marginal buyer won't buy as many. So he can still buy as many as he thinks he'll trap. He may not buy all six, and so we conservatively said we might lose 20% of those of the high mark, which was at 1,100. So we based it on that and just some simple economics.
Any other comments? Yes,
so
Sarah.
So going back to some of the slides in my memory, and I could be wrong, it looked like you were over budget by about $89,000, and after increasing some of these costs, you were up to a $99,000 increase, so you're over by about $10,000. That maybe, I could be wrong, but if I was remembering right, there might be a little bit of a margin that you could play with to bring that 200% increase for air licenses down.
What this will show is we're still going to be behind the curve. We're still going to be under. So the new revenue with Count and Fur Bearer and the new licenses on even the unlimited and six brings us $101,000.
All the new.
That's.
I thought this was what's previously happening right now.
This is the prediction. So we're still going to be subsidizing it some, just not to the same level that we were. So this is brand new. This is brand new revenue. So this is, you know, $5 last year brought us $23,000 from residents total. And so this is projecting out next year if the next presentation, if that model is adopted. This is new revenue from that too. So this is $10 in new revenue times the 91. So about 90,000 in new Bobcat revenue. And then you've got to add the 69 or so for Fur Bearer or the Fur Bearer license, and then we're still short roughly $70,000 or $80,000 to get to the 230.
Okay.
So this is.
I thought this was new revenue on top of what was already coming in previously.
Yeah, and maybe I didn't explain those two very well. We did two predictions. One based on if everything stays the same and we only sell 4,400 to residents next year. That was the 50,000, and then this one was a projection based on just brand new revenue in addition to what we were doing there.
You're still about 30,000 to 40,000 short.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. In previous years, there's been a cap on tags, and you're going to raise that cap off now.
That's what you'll hear in a minute. Yep.
By doing that, is that not going to increase the revenue anyway?
Should double it.
It will.
It's going to mean you're going from $4,405 to $9,015. Wouldn't the $9,005 be an increase? And that would be a small step that we can take and see where it puts us, and then maybe next year look at it again.
Yeah, are we back to questions? Pure economics, absolutely. If we went back and just had the increase number of tags sold at $5, it would increase revenue, but it wouldn't get us anywhere near covering the cost of the program. So it'd still be a shortfall.
Right, Rack. Any. Comments or?
I would move that we accept the divisions or our recommendation for the new fee schedule.
Okay, it's been moved that we accept the division's recommendation as proposed. Is there a second? I see no second, so the motion dies. Further discussion from the RAC.
I'd like to make a proposal that we, on the resident Bobcat fee, instead of going to 15 this year, just go to 10 this year, and then look at it again next year and make that decision. Kind of make it a little less painful for some of these guys.
I'll second that motion.
Okay, motion by Richard to.
So it's an increase of 5.
Right.
It's double.
So in your motion, do you agree with the balance of the recommendation with that amendment to the. Okay, and Danny, that's what you seconded? Okay, is everybody clear on the motion?
Is the non-resident as proposed then?
Yes. Yeah, everything else would be as proposed according to the motion.
And it's only one tag, but I'd love to add an addendum to the motion that it equals the resident RAM tag, and if it doesn't, if nobody wants it for that price, that tag goes back to the residents.
Okay, my understanding is those prices, like for the tags, that'll have to go completely through the RAC process, and we'll talk about it again and actually set prices for those permits, right? This isn't the setting of a $100 UTAG.
This is the establishing of the fee, yes. So this will go through the process that would put a fee in place next July 1st. So it would be time to discuss that.
Let me clarify. I'm saying leave the resident one at 100, but we jump the non-resident equal to what the RAM tag is. That's what the other states are doing.
Okay.
Nobody wants it. I'm not going to pay $1,000 for that U. Then it goes to a resident.
Right. Do we need to do two separate motions?
Yeah, I would accept that motion to be included with my motion on that.
Yeah, and that second that also.
Okay, I'll try and restate the motion then. The motion is that we accept almost all of the proposal by the division, with the exception of the increase that was going to be $15, which is a 200% increase, be a $10 increase in cat tax.
$210
instead of, and that when we on the price of the U, if and when the time comes that we need to remove U's, that it's the same price as a RAM tag for a non-resident.
Yes. Yeah, that's good.
Okay. And that's been moved. And do we need a second on this amendment?
I've done it.
You did it? Got them both? All right. Motion's been made. All in favor? All opposed? 8-4 and 2 against. Motion carries. OK,
Okay, our next item is the Cougar Management Plan revisions for 215, and it's the recommendations, and we will hear from Leslie McFarland, who is the mammal coordinator.
I want to thank you for having me here tonight and ask that you be gentle with me, and that I've only been in this position for about 4 weeks now, so be nice. So just a little bit of background here. I'm asking for some changes to the Cougar Management Plan and just a little bit of history on our current Cougar Management Plan. In 2009, it was approved through the RAC and the board process. In 2011, some minor amendments were implemented. And then in 2013, there were so many complaints and issues with the understanding of the application of the plan, both by division employees and by the public. So the Wildlife Board directed the Division of Wildlife to simplify the plan and work to allocate permits on a unit-by-unit basis. So on July 8th, I came into this job about July 1st. And so about July 8th, I was able to meet with the Utah Houndsmen Association, the United Wildlife Cooperative, and the Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife to talk about changes to the management plan. We were supposed to have worked over changes in the plan over the previous year, but unfortunately that really didn't happen. And so I kind of made an emergency meeting to try and come to some consensus before we came out to the public meeting and ask that we be given another year to review the plan and further simplify it. So the proposal that I gave this group on July 8th was that we would still take 3 years of data and compile that and analyze it by cougar management area because to take into account large-scale movements of mountain lions. We did make changes to the plan that allow us to apply permits and quotas on unit-by-unit basis, so no longer will we have a large ecoregion that the permits apply to, and then whatever happens in different units affects the entire thing. So now what you see for a unit is what you get, and so that's what we expect to be harvested out of those units. Part of our agreement to the previous plan required that we stick with the harvest strategy for 3 years and that we not make any adjustments or changes during that three-year period. I took that out and changed it so that we now will review permits and quotas on an annual basis and adjust it annually. And so what this does is eliminates the need for a female subquota because we're looking at the harvest on an annual basis and we're adjusting permits on an annual basis to meet what the harvest was the previous year. So for that reason, I took out the requirement for female subquotas. When we met with this group, they asked that we include all female cougars in our analysis. And so we did agree that if they allowed us to reopen the plan and put together the Cougar Advisory Board to further simplify and make adjustments over the next year, that we would consider a performance target that would include female harvest less than 40% on each unit. So just a little bit of background and definition. So a cougar management area, each one of these colored areas is what, that's how we analyze the data on an area basis. So the Ochre Stansberry includes all of that West Desert. The Cache includes everything down to I-80. And then the unit, so that's just to give you an example of what we look at when we look at cougar data. Cougar hunting units are the smaller units that everybody's familiar with. And so those are what we will apply the permits to. So that's how we will manage hunters within the cougar area. And then predator management units, those are units that we've defined as a predator management unit because the deer, the population on the deer, now I'm messing up. But because the deer population in the area is not meeting the management objectives, and so it has to fall below 90% for over 3 years or less than 85% in 1 year. And that also applies to bighorn sheep. So we kept most of the parameters of the, we kept the parameters that were in the previous plan, except for we took the most recent data and analyzed permits. So there will be some permit changes in the upcoming recommendations. So we used our current performance targets, which were to look at the proportion of adult females in the harvest to make sure that it falls between 17 to 20%. If we fall below 17%, then we would reduce permit numbers, and if we go above 20% female, adult female in the harvest, then we could increase permit numbers. We also took a look just to see what it would do if we included 40% female, all females in the harvest, to see if it would change our recommendations, and it did not. And then on top of that, we use a secondary target. So if So we look at the primary target, look at all of the units, and then we also take and look at our secondary target, which is to look at cougars treed per day, and you want it to average about 30%, 0.30. That would be ideal. And so we take a look at each of the units to make sure to see what the pursuit data says. And then we would adjust our permit numbers after the primary target was considered. So our predator management units are determined by our predator management policy. Regions can either choose a split or a harvest objective strategy. Permits and quotas then are assigned to each unit. And a unit would then close when all the permits or the quota are filled or when the season ends. And then we have three units that have bighorn sheep, but they have low numbers of deer. So we believe that cougars are maintaining themselves primarily on bighorn sheep. The quota in those units, there's no quota and it's unlimited take. And those are the Bookcliffs rattlesnake, the Kaparowitz, and the San Rafael. And do we have a pointer? I don't think we do. Okay. Do we have one? No? Okay. So this is just looking at historical harvest. The yellow line is a summary of all sport harvest. The red line is the summary of male harvest in our sport, and then the brown line is actual female harvest. And so you can see if you look back in the early 90s, our cougar harvest was actually quite high. And what you want to see, you don't want to see your female harvest equaling your male harvest. You actually want to see them diverge like you do in the late 2000s here. When it actually starts to equal 50% of all harvests that your females are, that's really concerning. So right now we're about where we want to be as far as female harvest is concerned. So then I said that we would take and look at all females in the in sport harvest, and when it was above 40%, we would reduce permits. And so you can look at the past couple of years, since about 2008, we've been below 40% on our female harvest. And that's all females, not just adult females. So our cougar season dates, this is the proposal for our dates for the upcoming season, and I won't read through each of those unless you want me to. And then this is just another slide that lists the percent. So I said that we looked at 40% female in our harvest. Everything the past couple of years has been below 40%, except for the Monroe in 2011. It was right at 40%. The Uintas was at 42% in 2012, and the Wasatch Manti was at 40%. So applying that 40% female strategy, we would reduce permits in those areas the next year. One other change, the Southern Region has requested to split the Pine Valley unit into two units. So the Pine Valley unit is this purple unit down in the Southern Region. They're going to look at transplanting bighorn sheep, and so they want to increase cougar take in the area where they're going to be introducing bighorn sheep in the next year or so. And so they're asking to split it into the Pine Valley North and the Pine Valley South, and it would be delineated like this in the map. And so the Pine Valley South would be a harvest objective strategy. The Pine Valley North would be a split. And the sheep would be put into the Pine Valley South part of that unit. And then just to show that we have, in 2012-2013, we did issue 347 limited entry and split unit permits. 2014, that was decreased to 285, and this year our recommendation totals will be 253. So we've decreased almost 100 permits over the last 3 years. So to go over specific recommendations for units, there are no changes on the limited entry units. All of those permits are consistent with what was recommended last year, so we're asking for the same on those areas. The only changes to split units would be on the Central Mountains Nebo, and that is a decrease by 7 permits. The Central Mountains Nebo West Face would be a total of 8 permits, and that is a decrease from 15 permits I have here, but I'm not sure about that. That doesn't sound right. I think it's also a decrease by 8 permits. The Mount Dutton unit, we're asking to increase that by 2 permits to increase cougar harvest to protect a recent mountain goat transplant. And then the Pine Valley North would become a split unit, and we're asking for 7 permits there. The Plateau Boulder, we're decreasing that by 1, and that permit's being given to Mount Dutton. Plateau Thousand Lakes, we're also decreasing that by 1 permit and giving that to Mount Dutton as well. On harvest objective units, we're asking to move the Fillmore Oak Creek unit from a split unit to a harvest objective with a quota of 12. The LaSalle Mountains will have an increase by 5 permits. The Pine Valley South will become a harvest objective unit with a quota of 10. The San Juan increased by 5 permits. And then the South Slope Yellowstone has an increase of 2 permits. The Wasatch Mountains of Inaklin has an increase by 2 permits as well. The Wasatch Mountains Cascade will have a decrease of 7 permits, and Wasatch Mountains Timpanogos will also have a decrease by 7 permits. And then the Zion will stay the same. And then again, we have the unlimited take units. There's no quota, and take is unlimited, and those are the three dark brown units. So I don't have a pointer to point them out to you, but they're the three dark brown units in southeastern Utah. And that's what I have for you.
Thank you, Leslie. And I remind the audience as we go into this part of it, at least especially the comment part, that if you're speaking for yourself, you have 3 minutes. If you're speaking for an organization, on behalf of an organization, you have 5. Ron will give you a 30-second warning when you're closing in on time. And this is Ron here. I did have one that came as a comment card, but it's actually a question, and I think you answered, but you could maybe talk to it just a little bit more. It says, could you explain why it's being recommended to eliminate the female subquota? I know you mentioned that. Would you elaborate just a little?
Yeah, so the issue there is now, before permits were on a very broad scale, so it made sense to do a quota. Now we're doing smaller numbers of permits in smaller areas, and what'll happen is it'll actually decrease harvest if you've got really low numbers of permits in an area. So, for example, if you have 5 permits and you're allowed to take 1 female, if the female is taken the opening weekend, then you don't get the harvest of the other 4 permits. And so it makes it really difficult to get the harvest that we need if it shuts down too early.
Okay. All right. Any other questions from the Richard?
Yeah, I have a question. I'm kind of confused. On the Central Mountains Nebo, are you decreasing the cougar permits?
Correct. And that's based on harvest data from the previous year.
Okay.
The previous year.
That's
3 years.
Still under predator management, right? Because it has bighorn sheep, also has goats now, right?
Right.
Okay. Any other questions? Danny?
Yeah. I've got one. So I noticed that one of the criteria was the number of cougars treed.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And that information comes from the houndsman, is that correct?
Yeah, we do an annual survey every year.
Right.
And we survey to ask how many lions they see per day, how many are treed,
right.
And then we average that.
So does that mean that the houndsman could actually control the number of permits by not providing accurate information? Is that part of it?
I think it would be very difficult to do that, given that we do quite a randomized survey. I think it would be really difficult I'm sure a few could sway it, but I don't think that many surveyed. I don't think at the level that we do it at, I don't think it would be that easy to sway the entire survey. Yeah.
Any other questions from the rec? Okay, questions from the audience. And remember, these are questions. I have your comment cards and I'll call you up. But if you have questions, this is the time to ask.
Shane Carter, represent myself. How many mountain lions or cougars do the fish and game release from traps? Do you have a number on that?
I don't know exactly. Do we know how many? It varies by region, and we don't ask them to report that to us, but I know that probably, just based on previous experience, it's probably around 10 or so a year statewide.
One more suggestion or question would be, do you survey trappers on how many lions they catch in a season?
Is that one of the questions? No, we don't. But I actually had a trapper ask me to add trapping as a cougar take method, so.
Are you going to?
We'll consider it in the future after I get through this.
Okay. Any questions from the audience?
Andy Lyon from Manta, Utah.
Hi, Andy.
Leslie, since the permits are being allocated to each unit and evaluation of the harvest being done on an annual basis, that's why you removed the female subquota.
Correct.
Have you considered limited entry then, given that? It would seem to me that's about where you're at.
Yeah, I think we'll have to evaluate that we can work on that as we go through the cougar management plan over the next year.
So it is an option?
It is an option, yes.
Okay.
I mean, still that would play into that would be some of the predator management policy.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
The predator management units are different.
Yes.
And I agree with that.
Yeah, so yeah, it's an absolute option.
Good, okay. Well, with that being said, could you look at the Wasatch Manti management area, please?
Okay.
And what I'm seeing on here is I have 5 units here that are not predator management units. And I've got another 5 that are. The predator management units that are, excuse me, the management, the, them units that are not predator management units hold one more tag than the predator management units. This paper right here that I've got off. I'm looking at 40, 45. I'm looking at 40, 45 lions, and they're not predator management units. And I'm looking at 44 here, and they are predator management units.
Well, since men pay, so the split between some are predator management and some are not.
I mean,
So the whole unit qualifies, but we chose to do half because of bighorn sheep.
Yeah. So under predator management for deer, okay, if a unit falls under 80% for 1 year or under 85% for 3 years, it can go, according to the plan, it can go under predator management.
Okay, these units are listed. They're not predator management units. You haven't listed them.
We chose because we listened to the houndsman. And we chose to not put some of those under predator. The Southwest Manti, for example, it qualifies. It could be in a split, but we listened to the houndsmen, to the people, our constituents, and they felt really strongly that it should be limited entry.
So what about the Northwest Manti then?
Okay, so.
My question is, I'm just kind of confused whether by management areas or
again,
unit by
it
unit.
All qualifies. But we're trying to do the best job we can to manage different interests.
Okay.
So it was a meet and a happy medium.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Any other questions from the audience?
Leslie, first of all, please don't let your jaw drive into the drain.
I might need to.
second of all, I've been running these dogs quite a while. I do appreciate the opportunity for pursuit season. That helps keep our dogs tuned up, and that's a privilege that I really enjoy. I just have one question. For the past 15 years or so, like the Nebo West Face, for example, and Tippecanoe, they've been harvest objective for quite a while now. I was just wondering. I'm not seeing it, but has any of you biologists seen an increase in mule deer as a direct result from more cougars being taken?
So that's one thing that we're going to start looking at now that I've come on board. We're going to start looking at these areas that are under predator management to see if we can determine if there's any effect or not.
Okay, because I'm just a houndsman, but I like to hunt deer too, and I haven't seen much of an increase from it.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot of factors involved.
So we have been talking about this quite a lot lately, and that's something that I'm going to start looking at, is trying to analyze if we can determine that if there is an effect or not.
Yeah, I personally don't see much. That's just cool.
Would you state your name, please?
Jason Wong. Jason Wong, thank you.
Okay. I think too, to further answer that question, is that we also have bighorn sheep in those two areas that you mentioned, and it's not just for deer. So, and I guess further, it's one of the factors that we can control. I mean, if we're losing X percent to roads and X percent, we can't control weather, and there are certain factors we can't control, but we can control for predator take on populations. So.
Hi, Leslie. I'm James Wild, and I hunt the Fillmore Oak Creek area, and I was wondering what the data was that shows that unit needs to be harvest objective now instead of split.
We recently released a whole bunch of bighorn sheep into that unit, so that's the reason for the transition.
All right.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the audience? Okay, seeing none, we'll open the comment period. If you're speaking for yourself, you have 3 minutes. If you're speaking for a group organization, you have five. Please state your name and who you represent when you start. We'll first hear from Ken Strong.
Ken Strong, representing Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. We'd like to thank the division and those groups involved in redoing the Cougar Plan and looking over the situation and and coming up with this new plan, and Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife like the plan, and we support it 100%. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. We'll next hear from Randall Cox.
I support Andy Lyon on the limited entry. I think if you change the units to limited entry, except for the predator units, I think you'd have more control over the lions. The numbers, if you had a unit that had too many numbers, put more tags on it. That's all I've got.
Thank you. Next here from Andy Lyon.
Thank you. We were supposed to have another fellow here that didn't show up, Jason Adamson. I know I've checked my boxes for myself, but okay. I would like to just add, and you can leave it at 3 minutes, that's fine, but I'm going to be myself and for the St. Pete Valley Houndsman.
Okay.
So I come before you again this year to ask you to consider some of the issues. Last year, you, the RAC, and the Big Game Board directed the DWR to have a management plan together for this year. They have waited until the last minute and quickly put a plan together that is substandard, and they have let the sportsmen down. We asked last year for unit-by-unit management, which has not happened. It appears on the surface that it is unit-by-unit, but if you look at the plan, it is all based on management areas yet again. We asked last year for all the manta units to go limited entry, and you guys gave us that, which I appreciated. It was later taken away at the Big Game Board. This year, they have completely taken away the female subquota on all units or areas. As I review this plan presented, the only thing that really stands out is the fact that never again, if you guys remember last year, will sportsmen be able to come and say, look, a unit is being way over harvested. We need to shut it down. That is completely taken out. If there's no female subquotas on units, they can be over-harvested as they have in the past, but never again will the opportunity to close them exist under the new proposed plan. By waiting until the next year to adjust the numbers on the units, we believe that it will be too late and some of the damage will be done. If permits are going to be allocated to each unit as proposed in the new plan, and this is the reason the female subquotas have been eliminated, then why not change the units to limited entry? No reason they shouldn't be. If the female subquotas are gone and they're not a predator management unit, there's no reason why they shouldn't be a limited entry unit. I would ask the RAC to review the Wasatch Manti Cougar Management Area. As I look at this, it puzzles me as to why the Central Mountains Manti units, which are not predator management, have more tags than those that are predator management units. I would like the RAC to consider the following. Change all Central Manti units to limited entry.
30 seconds.
Excuse me?
30 seconds.
Okay. Change all split units to limited entry. Reduce the permit numbers on the Central Manti units. They are not predator units, but have more tags than predator units in this area. Change all split units statewide to limited entry units, as it appears none of these are predator units, maybe a couple. The female subquota have been removed and are being adjusted annually anyway, and it should not matter now and only makes sense for these to be limited entry. Ask that individuals who harvest a cougar turn in a GPS location of the area for the harvest. We'd like cougars to be counted on the proper units. I believe that it is time we should start managing cougars as we do all other game. We limit the amount of animals in all species that are harvested. We also limit the amount of females in all species that are harvested. In most cases, we do not allow any females to be harvested. This is for obvious reasons. I ask that this RAC committee does the right thing and makes the proper game management decisions here tonight. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Earl Hansen.
Yeah, Earl Hansen, I'm from Fairview. I would just like to ask the committee to to make these Manti units limited entry unit. The last 3-4 years, we have lost a lot of our lion in that, in our areas there. And I mean, we've been hit hard. You know, we get a good snowstorm, and every guide in the, you know, throughout our areas, they're able to hit. If the snow hits down by Manti, they hit Manti. If it hits up by Fairview, they hit Fairview. I mean, we're getting pounded. So we've took a hit. So I would just like to ask that you put these into a limited entry unit. Thanks.
Thank you. Next, hear from Robert Olson.
Robert Olson from Fairview. I support the Utah Houndsman Association's recommendations that you will be hearing. I also support Utah Valley, or the Sanpete Valley Houndsman's recommendations. Also, the Central Mountain Manti units have been over-harvested for the last 3 years with this previous plan and are in dire need of some protection. The permit numbers are too high for the small population that is there. And they're needing some help to be able to recover to a healthy cougar population, which that is what the plan goal is all about, or that is a goal of this plan, is for a healthy cougar population. Last year, there were 7 cats harvested on the Manti Northwest. That was with hammered by outfitters from March till May. They were hammered. I mean, they were there about every day, several of them, covering the whole unit, and they were still only able to kill 7 cats. This year, we're allowing 10 permits to be harvested on that unit. There's not 10 cats there. They could only find 7 cats on that unit last year, being hammered. I just would like to see last year's harvest help this year's permits, and 10 permits is too many. And there's several other of these units that are in the same predicament. And Leslie, I appreciate your efforts, and I wish you luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dan Cocaine.
Thank you, Dan Cocaine. I'm president of the Utah Houndsman Association. in the first page of the Cougar Management Plan, it talks about the history, and from the time we settled this country until 1966, we persecuted cougars as vermin, and some days I think we were continuing that. just a little history, and we appreciate these guys, and we work with them, we'll continue to work with them, but a little history is in order, I think, because a year ago, we went to all the RACs, and the RACs brought recommendations to the Big Game Board or the Wildlife Board, and it was a mess. And at that point, they said, let's fix it. It was time to review, and we didn't review. We said, let's fix it. And we didn't do anything to fix it until on towards May, and we met one time as a Cougar Advisory Group, and we came up with a part of a plan, and we were waiting for some information from the science, and then we had a change in personnel, and then we had a meeting in July, and were proposed a totally different plan, and now you see a version of that here. One thing that we are really concerned that it does is it takes all the emergency breaks away. That female subquota was an emergency break. These things that we're calling quotas are threshold limits. That means we never thought we should kill more lions than that. Not quotas, not we have to go kill these things. Those are threshold limits. And so what we've come to is a part of a plan that nobody agrees with. Here's what we would ask you to do, and we're not here to point fingers, we're here to work this out. But predator management units should have been reviewed last year to see if they should go on or off. That got passed over because we were going to fix it. There are a lot of things that should have happened that didn't because we were going to fix it, and then we failed to fix it. We need to take a step back. If it's going to take another year, we need to put that emergency brake back on. We would ask that you reject the plan as proposed, that we accept the unit by unit. I think that's important. We all think that's important. That we add the female subquota back in, set up 40%, and that 40% number came from Dr. Stoner, who was going to go review and see exactly where that should be. He thought between 40 and 50%. Now it's gone away, and this 40% has come up in this other deal, and it's not science. We would also ask that we would consider a female, they are, and also that we would require these GPS locations, and that request came to us to support that from the conservation officers. Said it's a tool. If they lie or tell the truth, we can make a case either way. If they tell the truth, we can walk out there and find where they killed the lion. If they're lying, we can walk out there and find that they didn't kill a lion there. It's just a tool, and I don't understand. You know, I spent a career in law enforcement. I don't understand the hesitation for one other tool to enforce game laws. And we also would support all of these split units that aren't under harvest management to go to limited entry, and we would have a better tool to control the harvest. Right now, 1st of March, it's a contest. It's a timed event. If there's 3 tags left and there's 40 guys that want to kill one, it's a timed event, so you have to kill the first one. If it's a limited entry, you can be selective in your harvest. You can enjoy the harvest, and it'll balance out. Thank you for your time, and would answer any questions you had.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask Dan a question?
Yes, please.
When you're asking for the female subquota, which units are you asking that be applied to? Because that's not clear in your proposal.
We would like it applied to everywhere until we have the time to review everything, and we understand that some units, it may close them before we hit that threshold. But if you're asking for time, we're asking for time. We think that we need to properly review the plan. When this plan was written, they met 8 times, and they came to a plan that was unanimous. As time's gone on, we figured the plan may or not have been the best. Now we're, you know, we had one meeting with a couple of the people, and we presented that plan, and we don't think it's had near enough review or near enough time, and so we're asking you not to take the emergency break off yet. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't have any other comment cards. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like the opportunity to comment?
Aaron Carter, I'm just representing myself. I see no issue with these guys wanting the GPS location on them cats are being killed, because even in the coyote management plan, we're asking for a GPS location. I don't see that's going to be that big of an issue to ask for that. the rest of the plan, I think, looks pretty good. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, would you fill out one of those yellow cards, please, and then give it to me at some point?
Get a comment back here.
Real quick comment again. James Wild. I agree with GPS.
Come up here. Sorry. Then please fill out a card when you're done.
I agree with the GPS. We do need GPS on locations of where cats have been killed. We do have a couple people out there that do kill cats on the unit, and they actually go and buy the tags for the auction tags, where it covers a large unit, and they go to a specific unit in their backyard to kill those cats, and those aren't recorded. And I think those ought to be as well.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
What's to stop somebody from making up a point?
Very true. I mean, you can't.
The GPS location, and I've discussed this with some. So for the past 12 years, I've been requiring locations off of hunter-harvested deer and elk for chronic wasting disease testing. It's something that's very difficult to enforce or make people do. We've resorted to having maps at check stations and having them just point on the map. And I realize there's a lot fewer cougar hunters than there are big game hunters. And all I'm saying is it's kind of a... If you implement it, it becomes kind of an unenforceable rule.
But at the same point, you're assuming that every single houndsman out here is a liar.
No, I'm not saying that at all. What happens is you make the honest people more honest, and you make the dishonest people more dishonest.
And most of us, 90% of the houndsmen here, I guarantee, are running GPS. So we can give you an exact location of where that cat was taken, where a big game cannot.
Right. And
can I have one more second?
1 minute.
You know, our DWR officers in our county could have made a couple cases last year. Casey Mickelson, Preston Mickelson, which I've had a conversation with them and are all for this, and could have made a couple cases where some lands they believed were taken on private property had they been able to go find that. So... That's all.
Okay. Leslie, do you have anything else you want to say before we deliberate as a rec? Yeah.
Well, one thing I guess I would just say. Through these comments and questions and things, it appears that they feel that the safety break has been taken off. But quite honestly, we feel where we're reviewing permits on an annual basis, we're looking at harvests on an annual basis, we feel that we can respond to an over-harvest with the permits that we recommend the next year. It absolutely should not apply to limited entry units. There's no way that we can get the harvest on the limited entry units that we need to get. And one example I will give you is on the cache this last year. The female quota was met during the limited entry portion of the hunt, and it essentially shut down all of the units in the northern part of the state. Some of those units are units that we have urban and nuisance problems with mountain lands on the Wasatch Front, and we needed that harvest. And it basically made it so that we couldn't get the harvest that we needed. And so that's my say on the female subquota as far as...
Okay.
Oh, and then the other thing is that it wouldn't work on predator management units because those units are under predator management to lower the mountain lion population, so you shouldn't be limiting the female take on predator management units because you're trying to decrease the harvest or decrease the lion population in those areas.
All right, thank you. We'll bring it back to the rack. Richard.
On this limited entry proposal that you have, as I think about that, does that not favor a particular group? Only people that are maybe a member of the Houndsman Association that want to hunt cougars? Does that, because you don't do that for yourself most of the time, right? You do that because you enjoy it, you love the sport, and you charge people money to do that, right? You don't charge? None of you charge? None of you charge a guy to go out and take your dogs and run a cougar?
Unless you're licensed guide.
Okay, and I understand that. My concern is if you go to limited entry only, let's say a guy like me, okay, once in a while I've gone out, I'll see a cougar, you know, just hiking, okay? Doesn't happen very often. But are we taking away their opportunity at that point? Because the guys with the hounds are the ones that are going to dominate that limited entry unit. Is that right?
No, because it's a draw.
Well, if it's a limited entry, that's true. But if it's a harvest objective also in a split unit, then a guy could just go buy a tag, and once the limited entry season ends, you guys can still keep hunting it, right? And a guy like me or anybody else could just go walking, hiking in the mountains and, you know, luck into a cougar. But it takes that away from them, is that right? So that's a concern that I have. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that's a concern that I have.
Well, it's just like hunting elk. You got to put in for the elk. You know, limited entry elk. I mean, and once you draw, then you can hunt. I can't see a difference between the elk, the limited entry deer, and the lions. You can control the lions more on a limited entry hunt. You can put more tags on the areas that need to be hunted more, or less tags on the areas that.
But once you get into the harvest, once that you hit a certain limit of the cougars that have been taken, they close the unit. Right? It doesn't matter if it's limit entry and harvest objective or not.
Under the new plan, no. It would not close.
There's no closure. There would be no closure?
There would be no closure once them females are taken. None.
Now wait, what? No, so if you look at split units, okay? If you take a look at split units, on the Ogden unit, we're allowing 14 animals to be harvested. It doesn't matter what sex they are, 14 animals can be harvested. Now, when we take a look at that the next year, we will look at the percent of that, based on what our current criteria, we look at that, and if 40% or more females were harvested, then we would decrease permits the next year.
But let's see,
The 40% came from the meeting on July 8th when I met with you guys.
Not in the plan. The plan is still...
Wait.
Excuse me. We're actually past the question period.
Yeah. I just want to know, but that's a point of clarification that I'd like to have. On a particular unit, okay, you have a harvest objective. As soon as that's met, do you close the unit?
Yes.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know. And that if that's true, then it really doesn't matter if it's limit entry or harvest objective.
And that occurs. Yeah, and that was split unit. I gave that in the early definitions. Okay. On a harvest objective or a split unit, once those number of animals are harvested, that unit closes, or when the season date ends.
Whether that's 10 females.
I think having it reevaluated every year was gonna help a great deal, because if you end up having to get a few too many females for the size of an area and the number of cats there, you can rapidly adjust and make up the difference. I think it works both ways. Yes.
Just by way of information, if we did go limited entry on these central mountains, and right now we're trying to kill 10 lions, that's the cap there, would that be 20 tags to try to kill 10, or 25 tags to try to kill 10?
On the split?
On your split ones right now, you have the you know, that it shuts down once 10 are killed.
Exactly. So what you have is you have limited entry dates, so those people draw a permit. Then there's a transition period, and so when it transitions on that date, then people with harvest objective permits can come in, and once 10 lions are harvested...
I get that, but if we go into limited entry...
That would go away.
If you want to try to kill 10, you're going to have to issue 20 tags or 25 tags?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, we may have to increase permits to get the harvest that we want.
And under a 40%, if we go 20 tags, just so the math's easy, we could kill 8 females. Real easy, or 12 females real easy, or 15 females. So limited entry could actually get more females than, depending on who gets that tag and what they want.
So the split units came about as a way to try and increase harvest in areas where the limited entry harvest wasn't actually equaling what we really wanted to take out of those units. And so that's why the split unit exists, was to try and increase the pressure in the take, because the limited entry at the time was not meeting the needs that we had.
Thank you. Danny.
Yeah, Leslie, could you throw a picture of Utah back up on
there? Let me find one.
Yeah.
Let me find the units.
Yeah, that's fine. So what I found real interesting in a presentation that we recently saw as a RAC was that a radio-collared female, basically in central Utah, wiggled its way all the way into Colorado, came all the way back across, and ended up somewhere in the back in the center of Utah. You know, that just from my perspective, that kind of makes me feel real uncomfortable with trying to manage in little teeny tiny areas, and I think is the division.
So that's where the confusion comes. When we look at the data, we look at larger areas overall, because it's really hard to take and pigeonhole a mountain lion in a little tiny unit. So when you look at that map, those colored areas represent the area that we look at all cougar data for that area. And then we take that and we run all of our models and all of that. And then that's what determines the number of permits based on the female harvest and all of that from the previous year. And then we take and say, okay, we can have this many permits in this area. And then we start assigning it to units.
I get that. But my point is that if one female cut across those colored areas, oh my God.
So what we try to do though is take areas that represent what we feel would be typical range for those animals in that area, and then we also tie it to deer units as well.
Right, I understand all that.
We've
got micromanagers and we've got macromanagers, and there seems to be head nodding.
Any more comments or recommendations from the RAC?
Could you go back to your budget? The first chart you said there were three groups that got involved in the preparation of the plan.
So there was one other meeting that I held after this, and this was with the San Pete Houndsmen. This group right here, and I didn't put them on here because I'd made this slide before I met with them, actually. So I met with the Utah Houndsman Association with Dan and Aaron, the United Wildlife Cooperative, so Chad Coburn, and then Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife, so Byron Bateman came. And then after, I also met with Kirk Robinson, who's the non-consumptive user, and then I met with the San Pete Valley Houndsman Association to tell that, you know, to discuss this proposal.
Okay.
So it sounds to me like you followed the direction that you got from the Wildlife Board, and you followed the direction from the legislature, which was to get the people involved and revisit the plan, and you've come up with a plan which is here.
Correct.
And we have a group which doesn't like the plan, even though they were supposedly part of the group to prepare it.
Well, what I felt was unfair was that we couldn't have time to really hash out the details of the plan, and so that's why I'm asking for the full year to go through and actually work with these guys as a group to change the plan, make it simpler and have it apply everything unit by unit and put in parameters that we're all comfortable with.
So it sounds to me like we should go ahead with the plan you presented and get the people involved to say, do we tweak it? Do we have to tweak it? Okay. But to just say we're not going to accept the plan, I don't think that's not an acceptable position.
So is that a motion?
Do you want to?
So my head is motion. So based on that, I propose that we accept the plan as proposed by the division.
Motion made by Timothy. Seconded by Jay. All in favor? Opposed? 8 in favor, 2 opposed. Motion carries. Do you have a date on your beginning to work on refine the plan set up yet?
I haven't set up a date, but it'll be after the board meeting.
Okay. Yes.
Does the plan handle the GPS thing?
No.
I'm going to make a motion that's exact opposite of my previous vote, because we just voted to reduce the Bobcat because of a $10 request. I'm now going to ask people to buy a couple $100 GPS. But that I'm going to make a motion that we require a GPS location in Cougar Kills.
So that would be an additional motion, right?
Additional.
Okay. The motion's been made that we require a GPS location for Cougar Kills. Is there a second? Christine, seconds. All in favor? All opposed? All in favor?
All in favor.
All in favor, this first one. Okay, there are 4. All opposed? There's 6. So the motion fails. That one. All right, thank you, Leslie.
Thanks. You're not done with me yet, though.
No, we're not. Our next item is an action item as well. It's the Fur Bearer Bobcat Harvest Recommendation, and Leslie McFarland, the Mammals Coordinator, will present that to us.
So our current Bobcat plan runs from 2007 through 2016. The plan uses 4 variables to adjust permit numbers and season dates. The variables that we look at are the percent young, the percent adult survival, the percent female, and then the set days per Bobcat in the harvest. The ranges on the right are the ranges that we like to see harvest and the set days fall within. So if it goes above that, if more than 2 variables fall out of that, then we have to change how we apply the permits. So in 2011, 12, and 13, the variables were outside of the target range. So you can see the percent female in some cases was larger than the target range, and then the set days per Bobcat was greater than the target range. In 2014, 3 of the 4 variables actually fell within the ranges that we like to see it in. And the set days per Bobcat continues to decrease, and so we felt that we could go back to... what did I do? So we felt we could go back to... and I put this in the wrong place, sorry. So if less than 2% performance targets are outside of the range, we return to baseline, and the baseline within the plan is that we can allow 6 tags per individual. The season should run from the third Wednesday in November to the second Sunday of February, and then we would have no cap on the number of tags sold. And so our current recommendation this year is to have 6 permits per individual. The season would run November 19th until February 8th, 2015, and there would be no cap on the number of permits sold. And then other fur bearer seasons, there would be no changes from previous year on beaver and mink, badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, spotted skunk and weasel, and marten. And that's what I have.
Thank you, Leslie. Questions from the rack? Okay, I see no questions from the rack. We'll open it up to questions from the audience. These are just questions. I have quite a few comment cards. Mr. Robb.
Al Robb, for myself. I just wanted to ask Leslie why the season dates for most of the fur bearers on there begins in September before the furs are actually really prime.
Honestly, it's because that's how it was settled in the plan for starting dates, and so we're held to the dates within the plan.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions from the audience? They are, and our addresses are on the division website, so feel free to access those and send anything you'd like.
He's had a bad experience lately.
They'll be nice.
Okay, any other questions from the audience? Okay, we'll close the question period and go to comments. Our first comment's from Ken Butler. Remember, if for yourself you have 3 minutes, if you're speaking for an organization, you have 5.
I'd like to know why you guys set the bobcat season back so far to when it snows so bad. We can't get up into the high country and target the cats up there that's never been targeted. We get all the cats down low where there's so much pressure that them cats are wiped out. We should have a little bit earlier season to where we can get up high, get to them without too much trouble, and take the pressure off the lower cats.
What's that?
That's what he just said.
Your proposal is to start earlier, is it not?
The proposal is to start November 19th until February 8th.
It used to open the 1st of November, and we could get in the high country. Now we can't.
Okay.
And Bill, plan is what says when we start.
Yeah,
so the current plan starts it then.
Okay. And all the cats down on the flats aren't anywhere near ready, you know, that early.
But you get them up high, you can't get up because the Forest Service has the gate shut.
True.
Even with snowmobiles, a lot of it's inaccessible.
True.
Drifts, you see, done it, tried it for 30 years.
Okay. Next comment is from Sterling Butler. Sterling here.
My name's Sterling Butler. I love to trap. That's basically all I do during the winter. And when you guys up the cat tags, I'm not old enough to get a job, and I was just wondering how I'm supposed to get the tags. And that's all I got.
Okay, thank you. Jody Carlson. Oh, that's it. Okay. Gerald, do you want to speak to it or just? Okay, very good. Chad. Eva.
Eva, I'd like to speak on another comment I have about the check, our check laws, the 48-hour check laws. I mean, I understand the bobcats and everybody's pushing to get lower permits, whatever, but that's one fur bearer. That's not trapping covers all fur bears and 48-hour check, you basically have to quit your job to go check your traps. You can't. There is no trapping and doing it legal anymore. It takes everybody out of the game to trap, keep their line going the way it should, to make money at it. You're basically, it's a crapshoot.
It's pretty hard with 48, I agree. Thank you. Kent, founder.
Kent Fowden, Utah Trappers. We support the proposal as proposed by the division with one request for an amendment that we extend the season by 2 weeks. We feel there's two sides to it. Number one, we feel that would help with the juvenile survivability. And as Mr. Butler stated, in some cases it may depend on what the latitude of the extension was. It may allow some access issues.
So you're talking the front end.
We would prefer, most trappers are after mature toms, and they move later in the season. It does, access is an issue, but they do move more, and they kill kittens. So that's our belief. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Kay Diva.
I'm Kay Diva, and I just wanted to say about the 48-hour check law, there would probably be a lot more people that would be willing to go trap if the stipulation on the check period wasn't so long, and that would also help with the revenue with your fur bear sales and all that, your license for your fur bear.
Right. Thank you.
You mean longer.
Longer. They had I've received a lot of actual phone calls and people talking to me as well about with having to do with the 48-hour rule and how it would dramatically increase the coyote harvest too if it's. But you know, then I also, last time when we met about this particular issue, there was all the unintended consequences everybody was really worried about. But yeah. I don't know. Sometime I think we ought to revisit it because it's not realistic at all for a longliner. Our next comment, Deanne Butler. You want to talk?
I only said what I was going to say when I left before. I think that's on that part.
Okay. Is there anybody else that wishes to comment? Thank you.
Ken Strong, Reading, representing Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. We also would like to accept the proposal made by the division, with the exception that the season has 2 weeks added to the end. As for what Kent Fowden said and he explained in his proposal.
Okay. Any other comments from the audience?
Aaron Carter, I just want to agree with what they proposed and what the Utah Trappers and also the Sports and Professional Wildlife have proposed.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments from the audience? All right, we'll close the comment period, bring it back for further consideration from the RAC. Richard.
I'd just like to see if we could.
The library patrons, the time is now 8:45 p.m., and the library will be closing in 15 minutes. We ask at this time that you start gathering up all your personal belongings, start logging out the computers and printing anything you need, and take any final items up to the checkout. We'll be back here at the library tomorrow at 10 a.m. As always, thanks for coming in.
With that. I'd like to agree with Gary on something. I'd like to revisit at a future RAC meeting that trap check law. I mean, we really hashed this out, and we kind of, I don't know, some of it came more from an emotional standpoint than what really works. And I'd like to revisit that, and hopefully they'll put that on the agenda. Also, I would like to support the motion that, or the amendment that was made to add 2 weeks to this season for Bobcat. Thanks.
Sarah.
Can I Their request is 2 weeks on to the end of February because they felt that male harvest would increase at the end of the period.
Less kittens killed.
The males are more active that time of the year, and so there's thought that because the males are more active, they're easier to catch. But that's not the division's proposal. The division's proposal is to stay with the season as it's proposed. And that was just because we felt like we're being so liberal. Right now, going back after 3 years of limited, we didn't want to automatically all of a sudden increase one more parameter.
George.
Is there a reason that there's the 48-hour
A lot of it has to do with trying to get animals out of traps before the public sees animals fighting in a trap or that type of thing. So it's trying to reduce the visibility. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there's actually a long history with the 48-hour trap check rule, and it goes back to the humane treatment of animals and the best management practices that have been worked out by the National Trappers Association and by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so the recommendations they've had have been to go to traps with center coil springs and offset jaws and things like that. And I think as best management practices improve, maybe that would be a time you could look at the change in the trap check, but that's what it's been about is humane treatment of animals.
Timothy.
Just clarification for me, the proposal that we're dealing with and everything has nothing to do with the 48-hour
traffic. Right,
So we're not...
It'll have to be treated separately, yeah.
So we can make a recommendation to look into that at a future date, but it has nothing to do
right.
with the proposal today.
Right. Go ahead, Matt.
I'd like to make a motion that we accept the fur bear and bobcat harvest recommendations as presented with an amendment that we add on 2 weeks to the end of the season.
Okay, a motion's been made by Matt, seconded by Richard. I agree with you in some of that making it too liberal all at once would be better. It is not as good idea as creeping it along and kind of seeing what the effect was. If everybody gets six cats.
Well, if I could, I don't know if somebody could flip a light. I actually have. So I took, because of this question in the other RAC meetings, I took and put together some data just looking at the proportion of males in the bobcat harvest by week. And you can see that towards the end of the season, we haven't seen an actual increase. And the white line here is actually the average of all of these years. So the harvest of males by week actually tends to stay pretty stable. And then I also have females, and females it's at a lower level, but it also has the same trend by week. And then I have bobcat harvest by week, and those huge jumps are just areas where we didn't have data, so it goes from zero up to there. So ignore the huge jumps or the huge falls. It's just because those years we didn't have the data.
Snow hits early December,
And since the season's been shortened the last, what, 5 or 6 years, the season used to be a month longer than it is right now. We shortened the season 2 weeks on each end. And we've had snow December 6th and December 8th that will put a trap line out of commission. So we need 2 weeks on one end or 2 weeks on the other. We need a longer season because our traps are out of commission when we get heavy snow years like we've had in the past.
So it's not all about just the end.
The bigger, nicer cats at the end of February, the more prime.
Okay, we were in the middle of a motion. We need to either remake that or go forward with it and see what happens. What?
Yeah, we got a second on it, didn't we?
Yeah, we got a second. The motion was to accept the division's proposal as presented with the amendment that they give them 2 more weeks. That was right, right? Okay, did you stipulate when the 2 weeks?
At
the end. Okay, that's a motion that's been made. It's been seconded. All in favor? All opposed? 9-4 and 2 against. Motion passes.
I think you're done with me now.
Thank you, Leslie. You're becoming more durable. That's good. Okay. As far as the board meeting will be on August 28th, that it will discuss and finalize these same issues. It'll be in the DNR boardroom of Salt Lake. The next RAC meeting that we have for the Central Region will be on September 16th, and it will also be in the DNR building. Danny.
Oh, so we're going to have it
It's in Salt Lake. That's your fault.
Yeah, well, you know, I left a half hour early today and still got here almost a half hour late. So.
Okay. Wait. We do have one other thing that's very region specific. It's the Central Region, and it is the Deer Management Plan, and Covey Jones, Regional Big Game Coordinator, will be. What did I say?
All right. Hey, thank you, Chair. Thanks, Rack. Yeah, we'll get right into this then. I can see everybody's way excited about the deer plans. Thank you. Appreciate that, Amanda. This isn't staying. All right, so I'd like to say that all the deer photos in here were taken on Central Region units. We didn't cheat. Didn't go to the Henrys for anything.
Was it in this decade, though? That's the stuff we get on the news when they write about deer hunts. We've seen those pictures 20 years ago.
I never said anything about the time, Gary, but it was in the region. All right. You know, we really worked hard on these plans this year, and to try to change them a little bit is to be really unit specific and identify the needs of the unit and also the work we've done on the unit and kind of highlight that and not just to be something that's token but just also to drive the work that needs to be done in the unit.
Attention Springville Library patrons, the time is about 8:55 p.m. and the library will be closing in just 5 minutes. We ask at the time that you start gathering up all your personal belongings, start logging off and printing anything from the computers, and take any final checkout items up to the checkout. Our library will be back and open tomorrow at 10 a.m. As always, thanks for coming in and have a great night.
I think I can do this in 5 minutes. All right. So when we did this, we redid 17A, 18, 19. But 16 was done 2 years ago. When we redo the unit plans, we wait for the range trend data to come in. And the way the range trend crew works, they go around to different areas of the state. They're on a 5-year rotational basis, so it didn't make sense to redo 16 this year. All right, so this is where we get into what's going on in the unit. And these slides can be kind of confusing, so I'll explain this first one, and then you'll understand on the rest of them. The top box, and I put that up top because that's the unit, and then I put the range limitation in the middle because some of our ranges are winter range limited, and some of our units are summer range limited. In fact, most of the units in the Central Region are summer range limited. And then at the end, I put the trend of the range that we sample. Now, it should be noted that we monitor winter range. And some of you might ask, well, why do you monitor winter range on a unit that is summer range limited? Well, and the answer is simple. It's a metric that we've used in deer management for years. But the other thing is that the one thing that's constant with living things, ranges, populations, is that they're always changing. And just because it's a summer range limited unit now, it could become winter range limited in the future. And that's why it's good to keep a pulse on what's going on in your winter range. The Wasatch, however, is a winter range limited unit, and the trend is slightly up, so that's exciting. One out of the very poor and back into the poor or the good. So even though the trend on the Wasatch is up, it's not always the prettiest picture. There are several range trend sites within Salt Lake County that we can no longer sample because they don't exist. So this is a unit where we're constantly, development can really impact this unit. The stuff we have, though, looking good. Okay. So on, moving out west, onto the Oker Stansberries. This is a summer range limited unit, and we have... That being said, so the next chart down, I didn't explain that before, that's a desirable components index. So basically what the desirable components index is, it's range condition from a deer's perspective, winter range condition from a deer's perspective. If you were a deer, how would you see this? So we did see a slight decrease. We've had a lot of large fires in this area, and we've lost some winter range. However, at this point, it's still not the limiting factor. West Desert Deep Creek Tinnick unit, another summer range limited unit, and another unit that on the winter range that we do monitor has seen a slight decrease, increasing by one very poor site. And the sad thing there, I guess, is that we lost everything that was in the good. Again, this is driven by fire, mostly. The Vernon, you'll be happy to hear that the Vernon is stable as far as winter range goes. However, it still is a summer range limited unit. We don't have a lot of the high elevation ground that some of the other units have. All right, so let's see what's going on with the actual deer populations. On 17A, on the Wasatch West, our model is showing that we have about 19,000 deer there, 18,700, I wouldn't hang my hat on the number, but it's more the trend. The current plan objective is 22,600. We didn't feel like we needed a change there. We have seen buck-to-doe ratios on this unit increasing, which at constant harvest means that our population is increasing. So we've got something to work towards, and even with the obstacles we have to overcome, we felt like that's a reasonable objective for the next 5 years. The population estimate on the Oker Stansberries, and we've seen a really big jump here in buck-to-doe ratios. We are...
Attention, Springville Library patrons. The time is 9 p.m. and our library is closed for the evening. We ask at this time that you take all final items up to the front. We'll be back tomorrow at 10. Have a great night.
Thank you. So... We're above the old objective here, and again, you'll remember that I said this is a summer range limited unit and that the winter range was decreasing, but we're still not seeing, or we don't see any negative impacts on the winter range from deer. We're not seeing any habitat damage, so we felt like that justified an increase in the population objective and something for us to work towards. And on unit 19, really tough unit. Deer really dispersed out there, really big unit. We're about 9,000 deer, and we didn't feel like we could justify an increase, but we felt like we could work on that population as well. What was there? The previous plans. So let's take a look at what we've done. I guess I'd really just like to put in a plug for the Watershed Restoration Initiative at the first of this. We couldn't have done this without the Watershed Restoration Initiative, which has just been great for restoring mule deer habitats across the state. And along with that, along with the Watershed Restoration Initiative, it would never work without our federal partners. So a big thanks to the BLM and the Forest Service. We have to remember that the percentage of land the division owns and manages is relatively insignificant in comparison to what is managed by our federal partners. So them stepping up is what helps get a lot of these projects done. So along the Wasatch Front, we've done about, since 06, we've done about 1,000 acres of PJ work, some mountain brush work. But what we've really had to focus on here, and anytime you have a lot of people and a lot of vehicles moving from place to place, weeds have the ability to just take off. And we've done about 5,000 acres of weed control projects, and we'll continue. A lot of this was done on our Walsburg WMA, trying to control knapweed. Out on the Oker Stansberries, a little different story. We've done a lot of PJ work there over the last 8 years or so, almost 17,000 acres. Another thing to note here is the fire rehab work that has been accomplished. A lot of you that understand these fragile ecosystems know that really we have one shot. After these places burn, we have one shot to get back in and try to get something to prevent an annual conversion. And we've tried really hard. Now, some of these haven't come back to Great Deer Winter Range, but they're on track too. And so that fire rehab is really important as well. Habitat restoration, the West Desert. Again, we've worked really, really hard on PJ projects, trying to prevent catastrophic wildfire, create more resistant and resilient ecosystems. We've also done quite a bit of sagebrush work out there, and not ever forgetting the fire rehab stuff. So when we created these plans, one of the things that we really wanted to do is say, okay, here is what some of the limiting factors on the unit are. Let's target specific areas where we need to work. Wasatch West, there are some areas where we have the majority of our mule deer wintering. The north side of Sheep Creek, or the north side of Highway 6 and the Sheep Creek drainage, it's one of our most important, it's the most important winter range on the south end of that unit. And there's still a lot of work that can be done there, sagebrush improvement and PJ thinning as well. Walsburg WMA, you know, if we lose Walsburg or don't maintain good habitat in Walsburg, it would seriously affect a lot of the deer that come off that site up in Strawberry Valley, and everywhere. So Walsburg's really important. We need to continue to focus on Walsburg. The north side of Diamond Fork Canyon, a lot of mountain brush projects can be done there. And then, even though this is a winter range limited unit, Quaking Aspen Forest unit-wide, we are noticing more and more encroachment. So if we can direct work through WRI to Quaking Aspen Forest, that would be great. And then finally, if we can keep deer out of town, I think everybody would agree that that's a good thing. So anywhere along the Wasatch Front that would discourage deer from coming into the cities. Oker Stansberries, we've done a lot of work out here, but there's still some that could be done. The northeast side of the Stansberry Mountains, just south of Grantsville, there's some more PJ work there that we'd like to focus on. And then the southwest portion of the Oker, including Manning Canyon, Pole Canyon, and also Sitla Ground north of Cedar Fort, I think this is another spot where we're just waiting for a catastrophic wildfire. I realize a lot of this work is in winter range, and it's a summer range limited unit. But again, we need to remember that it can change and become a winter range limited unit if we don't focus on some of these areas. If we have catastrophic wildfire, these units could, nothing is stagnant. They're always changing. So we'd like to do the work first and prevent that. West Desert. So we'd like to focus on pinyon juniper work on the Sheep Rocks, the south end of the Sheep Rocks, south slope of the Sheep Rocks, really needs a lot of work. And we've been saying this for a while, and we'd like to really try to work there. The north and west slope of the Deep Creek Mountains, a lot of PJ encroachment there. And then any work we can do on summer range on the Deep Creeks. There was a high elevation fire there in, Mike, do you remember, 93, 98? on the north end, mid-90s, but a lot of the Deep Creeks has really overgrown, and it's a hard area to work, but as much as we can, we'd like to try to get some work done out there. Remembering, I guess, that this, at one time in the 70s, this was one of the premier areas to hunt mule deer in the U.S., and we've probably lost some summer range and carrying capacity. Okay, with that, thank you, and comments, questions?
Thank you, Covey. Members of the RAC, do you have any questions? Danny.
Yeah, I always have questions. So in terms of these, at one point, deer were entering the cities almost by accident, Now we've got established populations that are essentially habituated. I mean, they just, right across the street from the U of U football stadium, Mount Olivet Cemetery, has got a resident that might as well be a zoo.
Yes.
But because one of the organizations that I represent, the Salt Lake County Fish and Game Association, we get all your calls. So you guys evaded that by changing your name. But it's very common. No, seriously, it's very common to get a call about once a week of somebody who's just irate about the deer in their neighborhoods. So keeping deer out, we're a day late and a dollar short on that count. So what can I tell these people in terms of dealing with these problematic deer that are essentially living in downtown West Valley City or Holiday and highly,
Danny, you've brought up something. So I should state that the deer plans focus on population management and not on urban deer issues, and it would be inappropriate for us to go down that road in a deer plan. We're charged with population management as biologists, and we negate a lot of the stuff that's going on inside city limits, I guess, in these plans, and that's by design. However, we are working really hard to try to address some of that on another front. We've had a very successful hunt in Highland, removed 74 animals, over 5,000 pounds of meat that was donated to needy families in the homeless shelters. They, when you do the calculations based on what the homeless shelter dishes out, it's about 33,000 meals. We've been approached by Harriman, and we're working with Harriman. We've been approached by Provo, and we're working with Provo. We've been approached by Mapleton, and we're working with Mapleton. So I guess if the phone call comes into you, Danny, what I would say is the division doesn't have the resources to address all these problems by themselves. And cities have to take some responsibility because we don't institute no weapons ordinances. We don't say that you can't hunt inside city limits. So they have to take some of that responsibility upon themselves, and they have. Several cities have, and they're excited to partner with us and look at both control programs using lethal removal and trapping and transplanting, non-lethal removal as well, where appropriate. I think we all know that non-lethal removal can be very expensive and with town deer, probably not very successful.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Okay. We made some signs that no deer zones, and we've started to put them out. But
you've got to teach them how to read first. Covey, you mentioned Aspen. Now, you want to encourage Aspen growth, or isn't that what you were?
Absolutely, Richard. Aspen is. I mean, if you know a little bit of mule deer biology. Forbs and the tall aspen forb complex is very important to producing milk. So if we want to have healthy fawns, we need healthy aspen stands. It also increases the amount of water on the ground. And when you start to get conifer encroachment into aspen, we lose water, we lose the tall forb complex, and we lose healthy mule deer populations. They don't have the ability to put on fat for winter. and the fawns won't make it, the adults struggle as well.
So you need to talk to Sarah, and there's some places that I know that you need to take out the conifers.
Me?
Yeah. You're the one that really can get that done. Okay.
And they have been. I mean, it's hard sometimes because a lot of times fire is the only thing that will work in those areas. Mm-hmm. And on a major watershed, it's hard to light a fire. But we're working through that.
Yeah, that's why they call them prescribed burns now, not controlled burns.
That's right.
Because they don't always get controlled.
Yep.
Any other questions from the rack? Questions from the audience for Covey?
I'm Gerald Carlson. I'm from Eureka. In particular, 19 units. The buck postseason buck ratio has been down since we went to the 30 unit. Your deer numbers are below the harvest objective or the what you want number of animals on the whole unit. Why is our permit numbers increased instead of decreased, trying to bring those numbers back to in line with the current plan?
So I think, are you talking about the Vernon, or are you talking about the rest of 19?
The rest of 19.
Okay, so the rest of 19, I have my, can I grab this down a little bit? I can look that up, but I don't. So
your population objective is 11,000 something. You have 8,900 now.
So there are two things that we're talking about here. And if we're talking about mule deer, we harvest bucks, and bucks don't drive populations. If we're looking at a ratio of
postseason bucks is also low.
So where
both numbers are low. You don't have the numbers in your slides.
I need to. I have them right here. I can fire up my computer and get them. I can't remember. I remember every other unit but that one right now, for some reason. But I can tell you that if the numbers are low, we follow the plan and we recommend a decrease in permits. If the numbers are up, we follow the plan and we recommend an increase in permits.
The division's recommendations this past year for this year's hunts was insignificant data.
No, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is
that's what it says in the
insufficient data.
Yeah, but Kobe, don't you? You go on a 3-year average anyway, right?
Yeah, we go on a 3-year average.
So it's sometimes just not automatic. 1 year,
well, yeah,
it's down.
The 3-year average is still below. The 3-year average is below the goal. Yet the permit numbers haven't changed.
When
we went to the 30 units, the permit numbers increased from the year prior.
So there are a couple units here that we're not. I mean, there's West Desert West, and you're not talking about that.
Both units, the numbers match. I mean, the numbers are in the negative on both units. The Vernon area itself is, there's deer there.
The Vernon area itself is the one that's down. But, okay, can we stop and distinguish two things here? If you let me distinguish this, I can do this for you. We would never increase permits if our buck-to-doe ratio was below that. We don't do that. We follow the plan. We make a recommendation to maintain stable. So the other thing you're talking about is the population. Population is not driven by bucks. If you have 5 bucks per 100 does, 5 to 7, you will fertilize every doe. And that means that your population is driven by your does. Yeah. So, again, we would never recommend an increase. I know that's not the case. We might recommend stable. We would never recommend an increase. And I can get that data for you as soon as that comes up.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the audience?
My name is Luke Allen. Just had a question on growth control. Is that done mainly by the state's Forest Service, or
so? the habitat work that we do mm-hmm. is done by a lot by the BLM and a lot by the Forest Service. So we partner, design projects together, and work together on all of this. And okay, that's so, because of WRI.
So just a thought that just came to mind. If you're looking for help with that, would like asking the BSA for like doing scout projects for that, would that be out of the question, or would that be like something that could be, you know?
No, absolutely. In fact, we do a lot of projects with BSA.
Okay.
So when we have smaller scale projects, so the stuff that we're talking about is thousands of acres a lot of times.
Okay.
When we have smaller scale shrub plantings in that, we do partner with BSA. I work a lot with Eagle Scouts and other groups.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, we'll close the question period and we have the comment period. I have no comment cards on this particular item. Is there anybody that would like to comment? All right. I know. You know, he's guarding it. All right, bring it back to the rack for your consideration.
I suppose we thank Cody for the information.
It says an action item.
It is. We need to. Want to make that in the form of a motion?
Sure.
Okay. I'll second it.
Okay.
Well, I think that what you're doing is, I mean, you're actually proposing to your population objective increases in one of the units. So that's
yeah, a, yeah. So
that's
you do have to, you do have to vote to, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. That's
motion and then accept or reject.
Yeah. Okay. Is that what you're saying? So, Timothy.
I propose that we accept the proposal as presented by DWR.
Thank you. Okay. Motion is made by Timothy, seconded by Richard. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Now my wind down procedure. The board meeting will be on August 28th in the DNR boardroom up in Salt Lake. Also, and this is an important thing for those of you at Central, next Central RAC will be September 16th in the DNR building up in Salt Lake.